Accession number 29540, Mr. Norman Cole, Reel 6. Now, one thing, while you're in this area, there's a bit in your memoir about how you responded to a letter from home about French people complaining about bombing.
Yes.
You felt quite strongly about that. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, someone had written in the papers or something, you say that the French people were resenting all the bombing that had taken place, and the people had been killed as a result. Well, we've been talking to quite a lot of French people about the invasion and what it meant, and there was no element at all of them resenting the fact that there had been bombing and shelling and people had been killed. They were sorry, obviously, had been killed. I mean, take that for granted. But inevitably, they recognised that this was a part of warfare, and that part of the price of getting liberated was that some people would have to endure bombing and shelling. They weren't resentful at all. I never met anybody that reacted unfavourably because there'd been bombing and shelling to liberate them. Not once. And some would have been putting it about back in our own country that that was the case, and it wasn't true.
Now, after the capture of Caen, what happened then? You seem to move about quite a lot.
Yes, because it wasn't much after the capture of Caen, of course, that the Germans were retreating quite quickly. And one of the problems we had was, I mean, if we were going to operate, we had to be able to set up our observation posts before we could get working at all. Very often, we couldn't get communication from one post to another to do our normal identification of targets by sort of plotting angles of sight. And we would just be sort of given map references of what we could see. There wasn't time to set up telephone lines of communication and that, no ability to. So our whole job became quite different. We were on the move too much, too frequently, to be able to set a total base. We had 4 observation posts in a complete base. Very seldom were we able to do that as we were moving forward. The Germans were retreating too fast for us. We needed them to stop.
Did you pass through the Falaise Gap? Did you see the sort of destruction, the cows in the field, that sort of thing?
No, only by the edge of the Falaise Gap. We didn't come through it, actually. We went by the side of it.
Now, where did you go next that you remember?
I don't remember. It becomes very sort of confused then, because I was just moving, and not always from town to town, of course. Sometimes we're just in countryside.
Now, the next thing that seems to, I noticed from your memoirs that there is a confusion there. What about the next thing you seem to remember is the assault on Le Havre, or the siege of Le Havre.
I remember that very clearly.
Tell me about that.
Well, the advance of the British troops had gone on beyond Le Havre, and the troops in that town, that port, were completely cut off. We bypassed them, picked up the coast again, and the troops went on, and there were an enclave there, completely cut off from the rest of the German army. And we were called back to help to clear this, a bit of a nuisance, really, value of these Germans in a port which we could obviously, as a unit, use. The British wanted to use Le Havre. We sort of went up into an area on a cliff overlooking Le Havre. It was almost from where we were, there was a vertical drop down to the level of the port itself. And there was a chateau there.
What was his name?
Chateau Gonfreville Leish Orche. Gonfreville Leorche, O-R-C-H-E-R.
Now, what was the setup there then?
Well, that was a very big building. The chateau was a very big, quite a mansion, really, in a big courtyard in front of it. And the other side of the courtyard was a row of buildings, which were obviously stores and garages and things like that. We decided to take them over, and we moved into those stores.
So it wasn't just an OP, it was your base as well?
Oh, yeah, surely. The observation post we set up along almost like one end of this open area, and as you went to the cliff edge, went down a little bit, and there was a ledge there, which was ideal for us. We could set up the observation post on this ledge. Couldn't be seen from the road down below. Because there, you see, we were in an observation post, and vertically below us were the Germans. They were in a road and buildings and that down below us. And we were able to actually watch activity going on in the port of Le Havre. And I can tell you some things that we saw there, things that happened there.
Okay, go on then.
Well, first of all, at night there was quite a big anti-aircraft German gun firing away. And we were able to locate that one quite quickly. And our artillery came and fired on it. They responded, and that never fired again. And in daylight, I was able to see from where I was, none of the other posts could see it, the Germans were setting up, again, a heavy anti-aircraft gun right down in the dock area. And strangely enough, they made no attempt to disguise where they were, to camouflage it. They were just in the open doing this. So I couldn't get any of the other posts involved, so I had to locate it by map reference. I got the map reference ready, got that back to our artillery. They fired some airburst over. And by airburst, of course, they were able to kill the soldiers who were setting it up and getting ready to occupy it. They eliminated that gun crew. And I remember doing something that I'm ashamed of now. I wrote home and said to... I hope those Germans were killed like the dirty rats they are. That's not me. That's not me at all. I'm ashamed that I ever had such thoughts about people. But it was war. It degrades you. But the main thing about there, of course, was the civilian population. The mansion itself was full of families that had come up from Le Havre to shelter from the warfare. And I'd always been very much involved in first aid and medical things as a hobby. And when our medical attendant was away on leave and that, I used to stand in for him. And although I wasn't in a medical corps, I carried quite a good amount of medical equipment with me as we were going through. And we hadn't been there very long, and I saw a little girl come along, suffering from malnutrition sores, obviously. So I called her over and put some acrophlavin cream on the sores and that, and gave her some vitamin tablets to take home. Not long after, an injured cyclist was brought to me, quite badly injured cyclist. And I'd been able to find out there was forward hospital unit, quite near to where we were. So I took this young woman to this hospital, explained what had happened, explained what I had, and they said, well, look, anything you can't deal with, bring to us. And any equipment and medicines you want, we will give you. We will let you have whatever you need. Well, I went back, and the story is, whilst we were there, from 10:30 in the morning until midday, there used to be a queue of people waiting to see the doctor. That was me. They were queuing up with all sorts of things, and we dealt with everything from a newborn baby with what I thought was eczema, but on second thoughts was probably a venereal disease problem, to an old man with his arm almost completely shot off. And things like that, don't worry, I'm able to cope with blood in those circumstances. So it went on. But we were dealing with civilians. They were even coming up from local villages and farms from around asking for the doctor with things that had gone wrong. So I had to arrange my observation duties around their duties as a local medical centre.
Now, it got a bit more than that, because there was this girl took you to treat her brother or something. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, well, that was funny, actually. It was, I don't know. They came from a village down really within the German lines. Whether they were allowed to come up by the Germans because they were going to see the doctor, or whether they managed to escape up without being seen, I don't know. But just see, this girl came. She was a very attractive blonde girl. And she was suffering from mostly malnutrition sores and that. And she went back. We gave her the medicine, treated, sent her back. She came up the next day with her brother. And her brother, was nothing wrong with him. He'd just come up to accompany her. But he said he could help me. Now, in retrospect, I suppose I was taking a risk, but I didn't see it that way at the time. He said if I went with him back along the edge of the cliff, we could get to a point where we could see the German positions. So I went with him and got there. And in my memoirs, there's sketches I did actually on the spot at the time, showing where there was a gun emplacement, where there was barbed wire fences across. And was able to give some information back to our headquarters of what was in position down in the German territory, which I say wasn't very much horizontally, it wasn't very much in front of us, but it was just down a long way. Now, I, in retrospect, I mean, he could have been leading me away to be caught. But I didn't think of that at the time, and we did get quite a bit of information which we were able to get back.
And was that used, that information?
I wouldn't know. I got it back to the headquarters.
Now, the other thing, a story about about you, there was lots of schmeisers and things about that you played with.
Well,
is probably the word here. Tell us about that.
Well, one of these buildings which we were taking over as our headquarters, if you like, it was an arms stock for the Germans that they'd had to run away and leave. There was rifles galore in there and ammunition, quite a lot of it. And we got playing around with these. We got these rifles out and got their ammunition out. And in the valley across from where we were was the Schneider works, aerodrome works, aeronautical works. And they had great pylons with the electricity cables. And, of course, there was glass insulators there. And we thought it was great fun to fire at these insulators to see if we could smash them. Sort of vandals of the time, I suppose.
Now, did the Germans do anything to try and get you up there? There's a story about it.
Well, you see, our observation post, which was like along the edge of this cliff, sort of came on the telephone to us very quietly and said there was movement in the woods near them. So we got ready and...
What do you mean, got ready?
Well, get rifles and Sten guns and grenades and all that at the ready, and slowly went into this woods, moving forward in a very cautious way, of course, so it's not to be discovered or heard. And we got a fair way into this wood, and we didn't find anybody. They'd obviously drawn, there obviously were people there, and they'd drawn away. I think what had happened, stupidly, as we fired at these insulators, they wondered what on earth was going on, and they'd sent somebody up a reconnoiter and see if they could see what was happening up in the chateau.
Now, what towards the end, there was this business of the German commander just wouldn't surrender, would he?
That's right.
They ordered air raids. Tell me that whole story.
Well, again, it's one of these instances where we had to know what was going on. This German commander was told that if he didn't surrender with his troops, 1,000 bomber raid would be sent in to destroy them. Well, we were told that there wouldn't be 1,000 bomber raid at all. There'd be a preliminary raid which would go in, and that would enable us to locate all their anti-aircraft guns on the ground. And that happened. A smaller bombing raid went in, and very quickly we were locating all their anti-aircraft guns as this bombing went on over quite a long period of time to give us plenty of time to locate all the guns. The next night, the 1,000 bomber raid did come in, and only one gun was able to open up. And we were convinced that was a mobile one, because we didn't think anyone we'd missed.
Now, what about the surrender? How did that happen?
He did surrender after that. There was a long sloping road leading up out of the harbour, and it went past where we were. We were resting then because the actual fighting was over. And when they came up, the thing that struck me, they were determined not to come up as a lot of insignificant fallen soldiers. They came up as if they were on a parade ground. They had their officer there and they were marching up. They were in their best uniforms. They came up looking smart. They weren't going to look downtrodden. I admired them for that. They'd been through a pasting, but they weren't going to let it show.
Now, what happened next then? You seem to have a pretty fast advance.
Yes.
Towards Belgium.
Yes. Incidentally, just before the soldiers came up, there was two or three came up by themselves. And, you know, we had these leaflets dropped on them they could hold up to say they were surrendering. These came up holding these leaflets to show they were surrendering, these two or three soldiers. Instead of coming to us, there was a reinforced concrete manufacturing compound quite near to us with barbed wire around it to protect it. They went in and sat down inside the barbed wire. Psychologically, they assumed that as they were prisoners, they ought to be behind barbed wire. They went in there and sat down.
So what happened next then? The advance in, well, towards Belgium, I
suppose. Well, we had to go way back up again. You know, we had to come back to get to the Havre. We had to go on and pick up the fighting position again.
And that'd be in Belgium by then?
Yeah.
Anything about the advance to Belgium?
No, it was pretty routine. Pack up, move on. Stay. Pack up, move on. It's, we weren't able to do anything much. We were out of touch with the front line.
How did you get on with the French civilians, you know, as you passed through the country? Well, French and Belgian.
Fine, marvellous. We were treated like heroes. If we were going through a town, they'd be out with flowers and peaches, and peaches galore. Peaches were growing out our ears. And wanted to sort of shake our hands, and kiddies were shouting out, "Tommy, Tommy, Tommy." No, nothing but excitement from the people. They were excited at being liberated.
Any difference between the French and the Belgians, as far as you could see, the civilians?
I think the French were a bit more excitable, probably. The Belgians, not quite so. But not a lot of difference. In Belgium, again, if we stopped anywhere, they came loading us with gifts. Liberator was the word we heard over and over again, and we were the people who liberated them. It was just a job to us, but to them it was a new world, a relief from oppression.
What next then? You go into Belgium?
Get into that little
village of Westmalle.
Westmalle, yeah. That's where the shop was.
What shop? They don't know.
No, there was a shop there, and a young girl came up from the shop to where we were, and we didn't go into a building there. I mean, there wasn't a building for us to occupy, so somebody had a big lawn, and we set up what we'd call a tent there, which was tarpaulins over poles and that, and made that our base. And this little girl came up and gave us some, obviously, fruit and that. And then after a while, a lot more people came up with gifts and that. And it was, we were showering. Again, it was one of these instances where we couldn't eat all the peaches we were being given. And the little girl invited himself and one of the other bombardiers were on back to the house to have a tea. And they gave us a snack meal there, and then we had to come, and they invited us to come back the next day for another meal. And that day there was a bit of a fete going on. There was street dancing and so on. They got organized quite quickly, and they all wanted us to be there. They all wanted to dance with us, of course, and quite excitable. Yes, it's quite a... And that little girl, when we were leaving, came... I've still got it. A little penknife with a picture of Westmount Church on it. Gave me a leaving present. And they wrote a letter to my parents. And that letter is in my memoirs.
Remember, they can look at, yeah, they'll have a look at that, yeah. Now, one thing that I think means more to you than perhaps most people is when you went through Arras. That's a bit before, actually. But do you want to tell that story? Because it's where your father was wounded. Tell us about that.
Well, my father didn't talk very much about the First World War. He was in the Somme fighting near Arras and Albert and places there. And there was a golden statue on top of church. And the statue had been hit by a shell splinter and was leaning over. And the legend got around, if the statue fell to the ground, we'd lose the war.
Now that's Albert, not Arras.
Albert. I think it was Albert. Is Iris or Albert?
Yeah, you put Arras in your memoir, but it is Albert.
Oh, it is Albert, isn't it? Right. Yeah, sure, that's true. And that was still there when we came along. It had been re-erected, of course. It was still there. And we went by the woods where I think my father was actually wounded. He told us about this. And do you know about my father's being wounded?
Well, tell the story.
Well, my father, as I say in this, Somme fighting, and he was hit by a shell splinter which went through his neck and came up through and out the side of his face. And he was lying on the ground, left for dead. They'd left him for dead. And one soldier coming back saw him move, picked him up, and carried him back. And in fact, took him back to a medical center, and as a result, saved his life because he'd been left for dead. And we always say, you know, but for that unknown soldier, we wouldn't be here.
I think we may have mentioned that before, but it's good to have it in context when you went through. So you saw roughly where this happened.
Yeah. Now, saw the exact church.
At Albert, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so what happened next then? You moved forward to Westmile. What after Westmile?
I'm not sure.
That's October 44, I think.
I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that.
Well, there's a story about a British steel helmet that's quite gruesome.
Oh, yeah. That was just, we were moving forward slowly during this period. And we'd stopped momentarily. And I just walked down through the road to just sort of, you know, look at the village. And there was this very new looking tin hat, British tin hat on the side of the road. And mine was all scruffed and scratched and scruffy. And I thought, gosh, I'll have that one. It's a brand new tin hat, the steel helmet there. And I picked it up, and half of the man's head was still inside of it. It had obviously, with blast, had been torn off his head, and the body wasn't there. It had obviously been blown through the air for quite a distance.
You also had a close escape from bombers again. Allied bombers.
Yes, Allied bombers coming in.
Tell us what happened.
I think they were Canadian this time, as we understood it. We were going along a road and saw these bombers coming, and suddenly bombs started to drop, and we were quite close to a railway tunnel. So we just left the vehicle and everything and just ran into the railway tunnel until the bombing stopped. But that was it. The bombing stopped, they were gone, and that was the end of that story.
Did you resent these, you know, what they call friendly fire now, don't they? Did you resent it at all? Or did you understand it was just an accident? I mean, what did you feel?
I didn't resent it. It probably niggled more than anything else. We were so accurate with positioning everything, and we assumed everybody else would be as accurate as we were, and sometimes they weren't.
Now, during this phase, what exactly are you doing? Because it seems you're having trouble catching up. What were you doing?
Yeah, what would happen, we'd move forward somewhere, and we'd stop for the night, probably, and make a little nest for ourselves, you know, set up somewhere where we could sleep. And in the morning, we would be told we need to move on through a certain map reference, and we'd get a map reference. But they weren't sort of particularly towns or anything like that. We were just moving from one spot to another spot. And we were trying to keep in touch with the Germans, but they were retreating so quickly that basically we had no contact. We were moving and stopping and moving and moving on for quite a long time.
The next story I find is where you take cover in you go for a church. There's a wood with some Germans.
Oh yeah,
now tell that story.
Yeah, no, I couldn't tell you where it was exactly, but
I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. No,
in
there was
Belgium, though, from the looks of it.
Yeah, yes, in Belgium. There was this church in the middle of the main street of this little village. And we thought, well, if we're going to see anything, that's the only place we're going to see it. So we got into this church and went up into the church belfry, the church tower. And just ahead of this street, there was it teed into a crossroad, which was quite a main road. And the other side of the main road was some woods. And no sooner we got into the tower, and the infantry came up through, walked up through the town, and then went into this wood because the Germans were still there. This was the front line. This crossroad was the front line. And they went in to clear the Germans from the woods, which they did. And I think the Germans retreated before there was any fighting, actually. And when they were coming back, what I remember was we saw them and spoke to them, and they said to us, you know, we wouldn't have your job for all the tea in China. You know, you're stuck up in a tower like that. If the Germans come, you can't retreat. There we were thinking, you know, wouldn't like to job have to go up into the woods there searching for Germans on the ground, thinking their job was the worst one. They came back thinking our job was the worst one. It stuck in my mind. They had confidence in doing your own job, in effect.
Now, the next bit, it seems to be this business about the German soldiers surrendering to the barbed wire. So you may have got that out of place, actually, but was that later?
No, later.
Right, so that's just slipped a bit there. You're now approaching Antwerp. What happened next? You're getting towards Antwerp. There's some stuff about canteens here in Affy.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit later. We actually went through Antwerp as the advance went on. And then when we stopped for a little while, we were given 24-hour or 48-hour passes because, you know, we couldn't keep in touch with the enemy to go back into Antwerp. And in the city itself, there were three Nazis and a Salvation Army and the YMCA, and the Nazis in this country, of course, were Nissen huts and wooden huts and things like that. The Nazi there, the first one I went in, was a very luxurious hotel. They'd taken over the hotel complete with all the staff, and there was an orchestra there, a very good orchestra, still operating whilst we were there. And we used to go to the tables and have waiter service, what they'd been used to in this very high-class hotel, but it was a Nafi to us then. And there were two other Nafis. One of them was equal quality, one other was a little bit smaller. And the Salvation Army, they were the first there of all. They had a smaller place. But, it was a quality of service. And by this time, they very quickly started to use the theatre and the cinema for our entertainment. We had, you know, free access to.
Now, there's one story about the zoo and what they were keeping the zoo. Tell us about that. The collaborators.
Yeah.
Was that at Antwerp? Or you can't remember anything, whether it's Antwerp or Brussels. I wonder whether you can remember now.
No, I think it was. No, I don't know. I was going to say more likely Brussels, but I'm not sure.
Well, tell me about what it was then.
Well, what it was, you know, several times as we were advancing, we found where the local troops, the national troops, the Mackie type, had got hold of people who'd collaborated with the Germans. If they were women, they invariably shaved their heads, shaved all their hair off their heads, and made them march up and down the streets. men, they used to do similar things, to march up and down the streets in degrading ways. But in this particular instance, there was a zoo there. And I thought I'd look into this zoo to see the animals. And when I got in there, there weren't any animals. They'd put collaborators in these cages. The men who'd been, men they were, I didn't see any women, who'd been collaborating, were put in the cages just as animals were, just on display.